From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Here's something we've talked about a lot this year.
Bảo hiểm sức khỏe.
Đau chú ước lý ở tạo gọt.
Ngân đâm nạc, y biệt nạc.
Chá mạ y ám ác khen.
Say what?
Health insurance.
Health insurance.
In Burmese.
Current language.
Vietnamese.
On today's show, a look at the Affordable Care Act as it takes root in immigrant communities. The benefits?
The excitement of possibly getting coverage. It started a whole healthy way of talking about health.
And the challenges.
The same representative to speak with a marketplace representative.
She don't speak English well.
Also on the show, fixing the VA system, charging electric cars, and reading the minds of pink flamingos. First, the news. Accessing healthcare and not getting lost in translation.
Yeah, tại vì em không biết chữ Anh chị.
Would you please read it to me?
Sure.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott.
Into the surgery, their urine turned Kelly Green.
There's about 2 to 3 million people in the United States known to be living with epilepsy.
Itchy eyes, sneezing, runny nose.
Often it runs in families.
Circuit boards, using soybeans and chicken feathers.
They're nice and shiny, kind of pearly white.
Other people approaching them and commenting on how they look or telling them to.
I generally dislike buzzwords.
You don't use honey on your face?
It was felt to be related to hysteria.
They didn't want to accept the fact that you were on the same level.
On today's show, smoking pot as part of healthy living, dodging oil rigs in deep sea research, and congratulations, doctor, a dispatch from med school graduation. But first up, a look at the Affordable Care Act making its way into immigrant communities. People everywhere experience serious technical difficulties in signing up for insurance plans, and for many Asian immigrants, those problems were compounded by cultural and language barriers. Alana Gordon reports that many now face special hurdles in actually using their new coverage.
The new ACA marketplace provided many legal immigrants in the region with new insurance options.
The excitement of possibly getting coverage, it started a whole healthy way of talking about health.
Toy Nguyen is director of CMAC, the Southeast Asian Mutual Assistance Association Coalition in Philadelphia. His agency in South Philadelphia helped hundreds sign up for coverage, but it wasn't easy. The ACA sign-up process was mind-boggling the first time through for native English speakers. But Asian and other immigrants faced higher obstacles.
The misinformation about people's finances and where it affects people's pocketbooks were actually big.
Many work in service and contract jobs where private health coverage had never been offered, but didn't realize they're now eligible for coverage and subsidies under the ACA. Nancy Nguyen directs the nearby Philadelphia branch of BPSOS, an agency mainly serving Philadelphia's Vietnamese community.
There was initially a lot of confusion, and I think actually a lot of fear to try to get on because people weren't sure why they had to divulge so much information.
But she says when people began to hear tales of someone they knew getting affordable insurance, word spread fast.
Literally, our phones just started blowing up. People just started coming to our office, and we had to self-inform.
BPSOS invited in health navigators to help its clients. CMAC organized community workshops at churches and other central spots. Language was and remains a huge barrier. Munsi Taman came to the U.S. 3 years ago, after 2 decades in a refugee camp in Nepal. She speaks no English, but heard about the ACA from a relative.
I feel like I need insurance because sometimes we may have some kind of emergency and we may get sick. And when we go to the hospital without insurance, it's going to cost a lot of money.
On her own, Taman was stuck. The insurance applications only in English and Spanish. The marketplace's phone interpreters couldn't really help people sort through the plan options. Luckily for Taman, at CMAC she met Sekar Bastola, a worker who spoke her native language. Through multiple visits, Bastola and other CMAC staffers guided legal immigrants through the process. Priscilla Huang is very familiar with the special challenges Asian immigrants and refugees face. She's with the Asian and Pacific Islander American Health Forum. Wang's group found that even when the feds offered materials in Asian languages, the documents were rife with errors. Things like made-up words for premium and common metaphors sometimes didn't translate.
We did hear some stories about consumers, for example, of a Chinese speaker who walked into a clinic and said, you know, where is the marketplace? You know, she was driving around looking for this ACA marketplace.
Cultural issues complicated matters. Asian names often confounded government websites, leading to frequent errors. The marketplace relied heavily on credit reports to verify identification, but many people lack credit histories. And at the most basic level, American concepts like copays, referrals, and preventive visits mystified immigrants. Here's Priscilla Huang again.
For many of the Asian American and Asian immigrant consumers, you know, health insurance isn't a completely new concept. And in many ways, I liken it to even a lifestyle change because the countries that they come from, this doesn't exist. The system doesn't exist.
That's why many groups are as busy today as they were during open enrollment.
Hello.
The focus has shifted to helping people access care. At CMAQ in South Philadelphia, Wawa Jia and others are following up with people they helped enroll.
They don't know how to choose the doctor. They don't know how to use the insurance card.
Many are still confused. Ren Liu is a Chinese outreach worker.
I would say I will have a lot of phone calls every day, and my mailbox, I need to always check every day. Yeah.
Today, she's meeting with Lin Guo. Guo, 44, came in with a confusing letter, all in English, that she just got. Liu dials up the marketplace helpline.
Say representative to speak with a marketplace representative.
Currently with a client, she don't speak English well. So I'm gonna.
Turns out this problem is easily resolved. Guo, a restaurant worker, is relieved and says she's mostly happy with her plan, which costs her less than $1 a month. As for Monsi Taman, the Nepali refugee, on this day she's back to see Sekar Bastola, another outreach worker, because she's been snared by one of those most common problems for immigrants.
There was a mistake in my name and my husband's name on the insurance card, so I just came in to make that correction here.
Bastola tells her it'll take a week before her new card arrives. He takes advantage of her visit to go over how to pay premiums and actually use the coverage. Toy Nguyen, CMAQ's director, says moving forward, new community presentations are in the works, how to ask for an interpreter, and how to interact with a doctor. He and others worry how ready the health system is for a new wave of insured people who lack English proficiency and don't know how everything works. He's pretty sure the situation will keep CMAQ busy.
So if that means that after getting coverage, perhaps even some hand-holding to go to that first appointment, it's very important for us to be able to do that.
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Here is the makings of a big mess. 9 million patients, 320,000 employees, 971 hospitals, and a $165 billion budget. Oof. I'm talking about the VA system, of course, which has been dogged by a scandal about appointment wait times. Joining us now is Philip Carter. He's director of the Veterans Research Program at the Center for a New American Security. That is a think tank in Washington, D.C., focusing on defense and security. He's a lawyer, author, and served in the U.S. Army in Iraq. Phil, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
Phil, you just wrote an article for Slate where you suggested six ways to fix the VA. But to get started, I wanted to ask you to sum up the biggest challenges that have dogged the VA that have come out as the scandal has come to light.
The biggest challenge with the VA is its size. Within its massive $160 billion budget, it can be hard to figure out where you're allocating resources, or even if you're allocating enough resources to serve the 6 million or so veterans that come through the VA's doors for healthcare each year. And that's really the root issue beneath this waitlist scandal. It's not so much that VA employees are cooking the books, although it's apparent they are. It's more that they're doing so to obfuscate what is clearly either a lack of resources or a misallocation of resources or both.
So let's start with the fixes. And your number one fix is about resources. What would the VA need to do their job?
The VA's healthcare system gets about $60 billion a year right now from the federal government. And there's a group of veterans that estimates that it would require between $5 and $7 billion more to fully resource this system. The issue is how much care the VA can afford to provide to veterans who don't have a service-connected disability but still want to go to the VA for healthcare. The VA has long gone back and forth on this issue based on its resources. In 2009, Secretary Shinseki opened the doors wider and allowed all these veterans to come through, so-called Priority Group 8 veterans. But this has put a real crimp on the VA's ability to provide care, and they really have a choice. Either they get a lot more money, or they restrict care to only those with service-connected disabilities and certain other conditions. But they can't do both. They can't provide care to all veterans with the current budget.
If they want to provide care to all veterans, what do they need? More doctors, more nurses, more of everything?
To provide more care, the VA needs both more resources and a better allocation of resources. The population of veterans has changed a lot in the last 20 or 30 years. It's grown much older, much more geographically dispersed, and also concentrated in new places. Instead of having large veterans populations in cities like Detroit and Pittsburgh and Cleveland, you now have the second largest vets community in the country in Phoenix. As the median age for veterans has risen to 64, a lot of veterans are moving to places like Florida, then Arizona and California, the warm weather states, as part of retirement. And the VA needs to change too, and not just change where its facilities are, but what kinds of facilities it has. Overall, medicine has gone much more towards the use of outpatient clinics and more flexible networks of care. The VA needs to embrace that model more than it has. It has 800-plus clinics already, but it needs to move further in that direction.
So would that mean perhaps closing some hospitals and putting them somewhere else, breaking them up?
Yes, it would mean closing some facilities or shrinking others, and therein lies the rub, because doing so is extraordinarily political. The VA is, you know, perhaps the most political agency because of how many people it touches, how large its budget is, and the fact that these facilities are in every congressional district across the country. And you can imagine the firestorm that occurs anytime the VA wants to adjust its footprint.
There is a saying that goes, if you've been to one VA hospital, you know one VA hospital. They are very different. And what does that tell us about leadership and what might have to change in that regard?
So there was a strategic choice made when the VA system was designed to decentralize the system as much as possible and vest as much decision-making in the hospital leadership as possible, to put decision-making close to the patient instead of the VA central office. That's been good for some aspects of care, but it makes it very hard to standardize care, to standardize electronic technology, to standardize policy, and also to do audits and really to ensure compliance across the system. And so there's a debate right now in Washington about how much you might change that balance between central office control and authorities that are vested at the VA's 151 medical centers.
Could the VA work more effectively with the private sector?
One of the truths about veterans' health care is that most veterans go to non-VA facilities for their health care. That's where I go. That's where a number of my friends go. The VA tends to see an older patient census, and it tends to see a census of patients with service-connected disabilities, but only about a third of veterans get regular care there. And so I think the VA needs to partner much more effectively with the other places where veterans go for care and potentially find ways to leverage their capacity where in places like Phoenix, the VA is having trouble making ends meet.
Now, Phil, Secretary Eric Shinseki has resigned. Who would want to take over his job? I mean, it sounds like the most daunting experience you could dream up.
It does. And I wrote in Slate that Secretary Shinseki's replacement needed to be, you know, sort of part Eric Shinseki, part Bill Clinton, part Mitt Romney, because of the leadership, political, and business skills that he or she had to bring to the table. Reports out of the White House suggest that the CEO of the Cleveland Clinic, the major healthcare system in Ohio, is the leading candidate for this job. And he probably has the right CV. He was a decorated Vietnam veteran, served as a surgeon in the military many, many years ago, and has since become one of the nation's leading and most respected healthcare executives. That's probably the right skill set, although the VA is more than 10 times larger than the system he's used to leading, and it's far more political. So it's not enough to just be a great healthcare manager. He's also going to have to step up to act on a political plane that I think is new and very different.
Does it have to be somebody with a military record, or is that just how it's done?
Culturally, the Department of Veterans Affairs is most likely to accept a leader with some military service. It doesn't need to be a retired general like Eric Shinseki, but it's hard to imagine a secretary succeeding there without some deep appreciation for the VA and its culture, which is derivative of the military culture. Now, that could have been gotten through a residency at a VA facility or long service within the military as a civilian, but there's something, a sort of street credibility that you get when you actually serve in uniform, and particularly serve in combat, as Dr. Toby Cosgrove, the current candidate to lead the VA, did in Vietnam, that I think is important for leading this agency.
Philip Carter is director of the Veterans Research Program at the Center for a New American Security. That's a nonpartisan think tank on defense and national security in Washington, D.C. He's also a lawyer, an author, and he served in the U.S. Army in Iraq. Phil, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Pulse, driving electric. It's good for the soul.
I love it. I get very excited when, you know, I look down at my dashboard and I see all green. So, you know, that makes me very happy.
Glowing owner endorsements aside, electric cars are not that popular. We'll explore one of the possible reasons for that next on The Pulse.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. They are quiet, they are green, or greener anyway, and you can get a rebate, but still, electric cars remain a niche market. President Obama set a goal for 1 million electric cars to be on the road by 2015. As of April 2014, that number sits at just 200,000, a mere sliver of the millions of cars and trucks sold in the U.S. every year. So how do innovations like the electric car take hold, especially when infrastructure like charging stations are a big part of the equation? Zach Seward hit the roads in Philadelphia to find out.
Hey there.
I'm riding with Lori Bronstein on her morning commute to 24th and Walnut. She works at the Delaware Valley Green Building Council, and she's driving a black Chevy Volt, fresh off an overnight charge at her home in Cherry Hill.
I love it. I get very excited when, you know, I look down at my dashboard and I see all green. So, you know, that makes me very happy.
She's talking about the display on her plug-in hybrid that's kind of like a video game for energy-efficient driving. If you do it right, you can use up the car's electric miles before the gas engine kicks in. Driving electric means no emissions, although there may be some carbon pollution from the power plant. Bronstein has had her Volt for about 9 months now, and she's enthusiastic about its green street cred, but also aware that electric cars are still very niche.
You know, caring about the environment and caring about the future for my children and my grandchildren has always been a priority. So I was willing to sort of take the risk that I wouldn't always be able to charge my car wherever I go.
Bronstein says electric anxiety, the fear of being stranded without a charge, pushed her in the direction of the gas electric Volt. But her concerns there may be less of a problem soon, since her office building is planning on adding a charging station by the fall.
So this is the parking lot at 2401 Walnut.
Chuck Block is the president of Bedrock Group, which owns and manages this building near the banks of the Schuylkill. The sleekly renovated former railroad storage depot is looking to reach LEED Platinum certification and is also becoming a hub for buzzy Philly startups. To Block, having a charger is a way of extending the building's green footprint out into the parking lot.
The writing is on the wall, and in the future there will be a whole lot more people driving electric cars, and I think it's an important amenity for a building.
That's still a future tense proposition, Block admits, though Bronstein is at least one guaranteed customer. Other outfits in Philly have had difficulty in finding those.
It's going okay, and we tried to get ahead of it. It's the chicken and the egg sort of thing.
Paul Arabino is the chief operating officer at Parkway Corporation. The parking lot operator has taken a lead on putting chargers on its lots, using environmental incentives to add machines to about a fifth of its 60 locations in the region. But Arabino says they only saw about 1,000 charges last year, fewer than 3 a day. The number is increasing, but still, he's disappointed.
We haven't added any more since our two initial grants that we got, one from the state, one from the federal government, because there hasn't been any real demand for it.
That's because there's still not that many electric cars on the road. Matthew Stepp heads up the D.C.-based Center for Clean Energy Innovation, which has studied electric vehicle usage in the U.S. Stepp says the number one problem is that the batteries on which electric cars rely are still too expensive, and they're driving up the sticker price.
People aren't necessarily going to buy an electric vehicle because their business offers them a charging station. They're going to buy an electric vehicle when it's affordable and it makes sense for them.
At the low end, the Nissan Leaf retails for about $30,000, while a Tesla will cost you about $70,000. Back at her office, Lori Bronstein is turning off her Volt, which costs about $35,000 before rebates. She says electric cars are becoming not just for environmentalists like her anymore. Bronstein thinks that consumers will have to lead the charge if electric vehicles are ever to become as ubiquitous as she hopes.
If people see my car and I let my neighbors drive it and things like that, and people feel more comfortable with it, hopefully it will be something that becomes more commonplace in the region.
Maybe then the chicken or the egg problem of cars versus chargers will finally be in the rear view. For The Pulse, I'm Zach Seward.
1,200 electric vehicle rebates have been approved in Pennsylvania since September of 2011, and as of last month, 4 electric car charging stations are now open along the Pennsylvania Turnpike. 13 more are planned, but when they'll be installed is unclear at this point due to the project's dwindling budget. Our next story is about pink flamingos. Not lawn ornaments or the rather disgusting cult movie with Divine. We're talking real flamingos. Matthew Anderson is a professor of psychology at St. Joseph's University, and he researches Caribbean flamingo behavior at the Philadelphia Zoo to find keys to human behavior.
Flamingos are big, they're beautiful, they're iconic. It's tough not to like them. I study animals to learn about behavior in general. Psychology is the science of behavior and mental processes. And so much as all animals have behavior and mental processes, they're relevant. Flamingos are highly social animals. If I had to guess what they were thinking about, I'd guess that they would probably think about the behaviors of their fellow flock members. The Philadelphia Zoo has a nice, decent-sized flock of 17, and they've been very receptive and supportive of our research. You go and you watch the animals and you get interested in what they're doing and try to figure out why they're doing it. almost every aspect of their behavior is social in nature. When one of them gets aroused, they all get aroused. They're so highly in tune and so highly social in nature that some captive flocks and zoos, to get them to mate, you actually have to stick mirrors in their exhibits to fool them essentially into thinking there's a large enough flock there. I originally was interested in resting behaviors because if you go to the zoo during the middle of the day when most people tend to go to the zoo, flamingos are going to be resting. And so that's sort of where we started. Why do they stand on one leg? Well, we've shown that it definitely serves a thermoregulatory function. More resting flamingos tend to be on one leg when it's cooler out. And also when they're resting in the water versus on land, they tend to be on one leg more often. Water would pull away more body heat than air would. When they're standing in there, they want to essentially keep a little warmer. I think it probably has multiple functions, but that's definitely one of them, our research has suggested. Another aspect of their resting behavior that becomes obvious when you watch them is that they place their heads like on their back when they're resting, and this forces them to curve their necks to either their right or their left. We were curious to see if there's a side preference in this behavior. At least in the Caribbean flamingo, most of them tend to prefer to right. The big question that's still out there is, why do most animals have a lateral preference? Why are most people right-handed? It's not always the case, but when we see these population-level lateral preferences, why do they exist? And if you really think about it, they probably shouldn't. I mean, there should be a lot of pressures against such a thing. If our behaviors are predictable, it should make us easier to eat and easier to avoid if we're trying to catch you. That's one of the questions that we were trying to ask with the flamingos is, A, do they have these lateral preferences? And you know, B, what might they mean? If we can understand why other animals have these tendencies, it might give us some clue as to why we do. It's one piece to a broader puzzle understanding this issue of laterality, which is definitely relevant to people.
Flamingo, like a flame in the sky.
These are fun studies to do, of going to the zoo and watching giant pink birds. That's fun. And also very interesting.
Flamingo. With your tropical youth.
Matthew Anderson is a professor of psychology at St. Joseph's University, and he's written and illustrated a children's book, Pink Flamingos All Around, which explains some fun facts about flamingos, for example, why they are pink. Spoiler alert, it is related to something they eat. Jeanette Woods produced this piece. This week, the Obama administration unveiled one of its key initiatives to address climate change. For the first time, the Environmental Protection Agency will regulate carbon dioxide emissions from the nation's power plants, a major source of greenhouse gas. The overall goal is to lower emissions by a third over the next 15 years by having each state come up with its own plan. The EPA wants Pennsylvania to cut its carbon by 32%. So how will they get there? Jake Smels is the president of Pennsylvania's Electric Power Generation Association, an industry trade group. To meet the goal, Smels predicts the state will beef up energy efficiency programs and see more power plants switching to natural gas, two things that have already been happening here.
Society has decided that they would prefer to see other sources that are less emitting than coal-fired power plants.
But Smell says that could come with some trade-offs.
Those being that power prices could be affected, as well as the dynamic in which the reliable supply of power occurs.
Environmentalists are praising the plan as a necessary step to tackle climate change. Public health advocates say it could also help prevent tens of thousands of deaths. Dr. Tyra Bryan-Stevens directs the Community Asthma Program at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She says, for one, the new rules give hope for efforts to reduce asthma problems among residents.
The effect of greenhouse gases increases the amount of pollen in the air, which can affect, obviously, their asthma triggers. In addition, air pollution in general worsens asthma. We know that air pollution is associated with increased asthma attacks, increased hospitalizations, increased emergency room visits. So I think that all of these are good reasons that we applaud this announcement by EPA.
But in a state that is one of the country's top coal producers, the plan is also meeting intense criticism. Governor Corbett worries the plan will force more coal-fired power plants to close, costing thousands of people their jobs. The EPA wants to finalize the new rules by next June. However, energy interests and some coal-producing states are expected to challenge the proposal. Corbett's energy executive, Patrick Henderson, says it's too soon to tell whether Pennsylvania will be among the challengers.
I think what we want to have at the end of this is that strong, diverse energy portfolio that we have in Pennsylvania right now come out on the other end, where coal is still a significant contributor to our generation portfolio.
The EPA is collecting public comments on the new rules and will hold a hearing in Pittsburgh at the end of July. First responders are often affected by post-traumatic stress or have trouble coping with the tragedies they witness on their jobs. 1 year ago, a building on Philadelphia's Market Street collapsed during a demolition effort and fell onto the adjacent building.
This is a collapsed building at 22nd and Market Streets. You can see an army of firemen and rescuers on the scene. Again, this is 22nd and Market Street.
Six people died and 13 were injured in the collapse. Philadelphia firefighter Joe Shuley was part of the rescue efforts. He arrived on the scene in the afternoon to relieve the first response team. He describes some of his experiences that day and how he and his colleagues deal with the emotional impact of their job.
When I arrived, it looked like, because of the nature of the collapse, what was ultimately a pancake collapse, so there was very few voids created. So in our estimation, it was mainly a recovery effort. The assumption was that everybody in the building at that time would be deceased. But we still have to work very carefully for two reasons, in case somebody is alive, and secondly, out of respect for the person that's deceased and their family. One of the victims that we did remove, as I said, we're very careful to make sure that that we do everything we can to respect the individual, even if they're deceased, and respect their body. And we had to use cranes to assist us in removing the debris because of the size and the weight of the debris. And one of the victims was caught in the crane when they were removed. Everybody's different, and one incident may not affect me where another one could greatly affect me. And as I get older, what I've found is it kind of depends on how you can equate it to your own life. So, for instance, I have kids now that are 16 and 13 years old, so obviously it hits me harder when I see kids that are harmed or killed than when I was younger without kids. Not that it didn't bother me, it just affects me more. But as we're actually working, I think that we're so task-driven, we're really not thinking about the magnitude of what's going on. We're just trying to do everything we can to get the people out and to save as many people as we possibly can. But I think between hours and days and weeks after an incident is when it really starts hitting people, when they have time to sit back and reflect on what had occurred. On the Market Street to collapse, I think about the young people that we pulled out of the building. You know, their lives are just starting out, and now it's extinguished. They have nothing left. It's really hard to describe exactly how it affects you. We rarely have very frank conversations about different issues that occur, and that's somewhat problematic because it would probably serve some purpose, but. It's difficult, you know. It's difficult for people to talk about when, you know, not just this building collapse, but all kinds of incidences we respond to, and we see and deal with things that people shouldn't have to see and deal with daily. You know, people withdraw, so somebody that's typically engaged and talkative and friendly becomes quiet, and they're keeping to themselves more and more. We see a lot of divorces, marital problems. You'll see drinking, potential drug use, things like that. That's, you know, they're all related to what these guys experience day in and day out. So we have an employment assistance program, which is available. However, it's not readily available, and it's not where we would like to see it at, in that we'd like to see it more proactive, more engaged in individuals, because right now they'll meet as a group, and then if anyone has problems, they can go individually and meet with a counselor and discuss their issues. But again, when you get a group of people together, nobody wants to show, you know, any weakness or any kink in the armor. Everybody's pretty much quiet. So we would like to see it expanded, their role expanded more to identify incidences as they occur and then get out to the stations and just talk to the people individually, because a lot of guys really don't know until the incident occurs or until they need help and they're reluctant to ask for it. So you almost need somebody reaching out saying, here's the help, come get it.
Joe Shuley is a battalion chief with the Philadelphia Fire Department. He's currently on leave to serve as president for the Firefighters and Paramedics Union. Coming up on The Pulse, a Temple research crew pulls up to the largest coral reef in the northern Gulf of Mexico to find a slight complication.
The captain called me up to the bridge, and I went up there, and he said, "We can't go where you want to go." And I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Look at that." And I said, who's that? I have never seen that before.
That's next on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. The Gulf of Mexico is vast, but sometimes still not big enough for different parties to do their thing. A few weeks ago, we spoke with Dr. Eric Cordes. He's Associate Professor of Biology at Temple University, and we talked to him while he was aboard the submersible Alvin, collecting samples from corals to study the effects of ocean acidification on the deep sea. He says that during this most recent trip, oil drilling rigs made his work much more difficult.
I was really astounded. This was the most energy company activity I've ever seen out there. It seems to have really increased. And that's just a sense, you know, I've been going out in the Gulf of Mexico each year for the past 15 years. And this was the highest level of activity that I've seen the whole time I've been out there.
What does that mean for your research?
Well, so our very first day, we pulled up to the largest coral reef in the northern Gulf of Mexico, and there was a brand new drilling ship less than a mile from the reef, sitting right where we wanted to go. The captain called me up to the bridge, and I went up there, and he said, "You know what? We can't go where you want to go." And I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Look at that." And I said, Who's that? I have never seen that before. What's going on here? And we talked to them. We got them on the radio and talked to them for a little while. And the oil rigs can't be less than 2,000 feet from the edge of that border. And anything that they have on the seafloor, this is a floating ship. And so it has anchor chains that go out in all directions to keep it in that spot. And those anchor placements can't be within 500 feet of the edge of this reef. Now, that's a very large anchor holding a oil drilling ship in place 500 feet away from a coral reef, which seems a little close to me. Now, the drilling ship itself has a setback, so we can't get within a mile of it. So they can get within 2,000 feet of the edge of my coral reef, but my ship can't get within a mile of them, which effectively puts a few thousand feet of coral reef off limits to research because they're drilling for oil right next to this reef.
So you couldn't go to a couple of places you wanted to?
Right.
And do you see in your research, do you see any effects of the oil drilling industry and also of oil spills?
We did, you know, anecdotally see a lot of material in the water. We were just downstream from them diving on the reef, and there was a lot of material in the water. And so we took some samples to see if maybe there were some of the metals that you find in drill cuttings that may have been washing onto the reef. And so we don't know that yet, but we're checking that out. But then a lot of my work over the last few years, because I've been diving in these areas for so long, we did get really involved in the work following up the oil spill, and we found now four different coral sites in deep waters around where the oil spill was that have been impacted. And we've now published all that information, and we're doing follow-up studies to watch them in the future.
And what kind of impact do you see on those corals?
At the closest sites, over 50% of the population was covered in this oil material, which actually probably went all the way to the surface, got mixed up with plankton and rained back down in this sort of oil snow and hit the corals and stuck to them, and the tissue underneath degraded. And a lot of them have just continued to go downhill since then.
Yeah. Can they survive that?
If the damage is really light, it looks like some of them can survive and recover from it. But if the damage was heavy, if it was over 50% of the colony, they're not recovering.
So they suffocate, or how could we imagine that?
It's just the toxicity of the oil on their skin. Their tissues are really, really thin. There's not a whole lot protecting them from the external environment. And so it's actually the toxicity of the hydrocarbons on those tissues that causes the damage.
Dr. Eric Cordes is an associate professor of biology at Temple University. The coral samples he brought back from the Gulf of Mexico are still being tested in the lab, but we'll check back with him in a few weeks to find out what they've learned about ocean acidification and to see a photo of the deep sea coral sample and of the recent trip. Go to our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Now for our series, Patient Files, your stories of illness, recovery, and coping. In today's edition, a look at medical marijuana. 22 states have made medical marijuana available to patients. It's an option in Delaware and New Jersey. In Pennsylvania, the debate over allowing it continues. Lobbyist Jay Lassiter of Cherry Hill worked to get medical marijuana approved in New Jersey and uses the substance daily to help him cope with his illness.
I remember looking at the receipt the first time I purchased legal cannabis in New Jersey, and I just felt so legitimate, you know? It just was an extraordinary feeling. I changed the laws, man. It was a moment of professional and personal and a lot of pride, because it was a hard-fought victory, and we earned it. You know, it's like having a baby. I mean, it's not the prettiest baby in the world, but the medical marijuana program is our baby, and I love it. I was diagnosed with HIV in 1994. So I kind of say I'm the class of 1994. And a lot of people from the class of 1993 are dead. So I was right there at that cutoff, and I was a teenager at the time. And the easiest way to live a long, healthy life with HIV is to take your meds every single day and at the same time, if possible, to bring a very disciplined kind of regimen so that you're making sure your immune system is 100%. You can't miss your meds. If your stomach is rebelling and you're not able to take your meds, that is very consequential. You can't miss food. You have to eat. You can't take these meds on an empty stomach either. So for me, the marijuana, very early on, it emerged as one of many tools in my toolbox to cope with being HIV positive. And after 21 years, I think I've done an okay job with that. There are a lot of tools that I use to stay healthy. Cannabis is just one of them. You know, the rumors about pot are true. It definitely increases your appetite. What I have noticed that when I need it therapeutically, say medically, you don't get the same euphoria when you consume it. So if my stomach's not feeling well and I need to take my meds before I go to bed, and that doesn't seem like it's going to happen, I'll just take a little puff of cannabis and wait a half an hour. Usually it calms my stomach right down. I'll take the meds just fine. And of course, if it has the unintended side effect of increasing my appetite, well, okay, I'll take it. Oops. Monday kind of slipped out a little bit. So that is, for example, my medication for one day. That's one day's worth. I call them my whateverals because I've been on so many different HIV meds over the years that I can't even keep track. I usually say the yellow one, the beige one, and then the little blue one that looks kind of like Viagra. I take them all at night, usually around 9 o'clock, take a little puff, take my meds. You know, I'm usually in bed by 10, 10:30. This is my fancy marijuana stash container. Hang on one second. I'll get it going. And there you are, just one little hit. I myself use cannabis to be well. It's a function of my well-being, of my living healthy and being healthy and aspiring to that and wanting longevity. There are a lot of people who use cannabis to not be sick. And I'm referring here to, in New Jersey, for example, 1 in 3 New Jersey residents will be diagnosed with a cancer diagnosis in their lifetime. 25,000 New Jersey residents have died in hospice since Christmas. So that's a lot of people who could benefit from this science. And because the science is so primitive, because we're just barely getting around to having medical marijuana and sort of accepting it, there's not a whole lot of research about what kinds of strains are most suitable for certain diseases. And that's a pity.
Jay Lassiter is a political consultant and lobbyist and uses marijuana to help him cope with the symptoms of HIV. On last week's show, we heard a commentary from Rebecca Rupp, a blogger for National Geographic's The Plate, who explained why she is pro-GMO. We got a lot of response to this piece, and I wanted to share a couple of those responses with you. Anne-Marie writes, "Unfortunately, we are now seeing health epidemics in this country, skyrocketing increases in allergies, autism, obesity, and diabetes, as well as other illnesses. Granted, the correlation between the introduction of GMO foods and the subsequent increases in these conditions do not prove causation, it would be wise for us to exercise the precautionary principle and take these foods off the market until it can be proven that they do no harm." D.R. Case writes, "We, scientists included, don't know whether these modified foods are safe, and we can't know. People everywhere are becoming part of a giant experiment to see if GMOs are safe. In the U.S., we don't even require labeling so that people can make their choices with their wallets." We appreciate your feedback. Anything you want to tell us, send us an email, thepulse@whyy.org. At the end of med school, newly minted doctors take the Hippocratic Oath and then embark on a new journey in their professional career. We checked out Thomas Jefferson University's medical school commencement last week to hear from some graduates about this pivotal moment.
I now invite all physicians, both here on stage as well as in the audience, to stand and take the Oath of Hippocrates along with the graduating class of 2014. I do solemnly swear by all that I hold most sacred.
I do solemnly swear by that which I hold most sacred.
that I will be loyal to the profession of medicine, just to its members, and generous to its institutions.
As of today, I'll be officially a doctor. 5 years of residency. Then I'll be a urologist after that. Right now, the biggest thing is just the adjustment from being a student to actually becoming a doctor and having a little more responsibility. Start orientation mid-June. They have something called intern boot camp, and then some training and modules for, you know, advanced critical life support and things like that. And then July 1st is when I think everyone starts residency.
I guess my greatest hope would be that, you know, I can really, you know, create the best relationships with my patients, especially because I'm going into a surgical field. I think it's really hard to keep that balance. I'm definitely anxious just because now that I do have a degree, now that I'm responsible for patients, it is definitely really scary. And I think everyone is scared, you know, to start and make that first mistake.
In our world of biomedicine, the impossible morphs into the possible at a dizzying pace. Just this past year, for the visually impaired, next-generation Google Glass that converts into words what the eyeglasses see. For the cancer-ridden, injectable nanosatellites that propel themselves to tumor beds and heat them into oblivion.
Well, I think medicine will look a lot cheaper and hopefully more coverage, and we'll have universal health care. I don't know. It'd be nice to see where this Obamacare is going to go.
As a student, there's always this sense of, you know, what have I gotten myself into? How much did I bite off more than I can chew? I'm really excited about the potential for having a meaningful impact on patients' lives. That's really why I went into medicine in the first place. Excited to be going to the hospitals. Less excited about starting to finally pay back all my loans. Medical school is expensive, so that's one of the realistic things that we have to sort of start thinking about now.
These things I do promise upon my honor. God bless.
You just heard brand new doctors Kushan Radadia, Leanne Tu, Paul Leonard, and Carlos Ortega. Laura Benchoff produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English and Alana Gordon. Today, we must say goodbye to our friend Zach Seward, who is leaving us to become an editor. We'll miss Zach's adventures from ripening bananas to predicting the weather and dissecting healthcare bills, and we wish him the best. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson, our associate producer, Megan Pinto, our executive producer, Chris Cetullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, you can subscribe to our podcast on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.